We come tonight to continue our studies in the book of Ezra into chapter 4. We've read it, it's obvious the theme of it, that here we have the beginning of hostility to God's work. Whenever there is a work of God, or whenever there is a work of grace started, then it immediately mobilizes the opposition of the Prince of Darkness to it. And there is, from that point onwards, a constant battle being fought in the world or in the soul. The Gospel tells us to count the cost of commitment to the Lord for that very purpose, because there will be an intense, prolonged battle of good and evil always. And the battlefield is the human soul and life. And we must needs therefore be ready when it comes. Because come it will from any direction, often the directions we least expect it. It comes at times all dressed up and attractive. Other times it comes with all of the stench of the pit about it, and we see it for what it is. There are times when it comes like the roar of a lion. There are other times when it comes with the enticement of the spider. "Come into my web," the spider said to the fly. Opposition. And from this point onward in Ezra chapter 4, right through to the book of Nehemiah, there is conflict constantly before us. We do not have to read much of any one chapter to find that theme constantly coming back to us. It comes from different sources. It comes in different forms. But no matter what kind, no matter what time, no matter what variety there is, the end is always the same: to try to stop the work of God. Here, to stop the construction of the temple, the city, and the restoration of the land to his people. New Testament times, to stop the work of any interest, maturing, or development in the Lord or in the concerns of our soul. Opposition then, and here we have it for us. But before we come into this chapter, it is vitally important that we do this. It's vitally important to understand this chapter that we also grasp hold of the time frame in which it is written. If you read it, it is very difficult to make sense of it unless we've got the key to open it up for ourselves. And that's what I want to do right at the very beginning tonight. Now, verses 1 through 5. Verses 1 to 5 are fairly plain. They run and they cover the years after the decree was given by Cyrus. So we're covering here about the time 536-537. But it's not long after that work is started when it stopped. And it's paused for 18 years until the second year of Darius. So what I want us to do when we read chapter 4 is read verses 1 to 5 and then immediately go to verse 24, because that is the logical timeline. Because the word "then," the beginning of verse 24, refers to the events of 1 through 5. "Then ceased the work of the house of the Lord," which is at Jerusalem. "So ceased until the second year of reign of Darius, the king of Persia." So we've got that in our mind first of all. 1 through 5, and then verse 24. But then the question is, what are we going to do verses 6 through 23? And two of the commentators, the most respected of commentators, come up with exactly the same answer to this section of chapter 4. It's a very simple answer. We put brackets around it. Put brackets round verses 6 through to 23. And what the writer of Ezra is doing here is, bear in mind that chapter 4 starts with opposition and hostility. And then the work stops when you get to verse 24. What the writer is doing is, having got to verse 5, he then carries on. And he goes down through the history, down through the generations. And he says, yes, the opposition started then, but it carried on like this, like this, like this, like this. So when you go from verse 6 through to 23, you're going down through the centuries. Down through Ahasuerus, down through Artaxerxes. And all of these kings that are mentioned in the middle part of this chapter came after Darius. So what we've got is the theme of opposition is carried on from 6 through 23. And when you get to the end of verse 23, they stop the work. But that stopping of the work is different from the stopping of the work in verse 24. And that's important to understand as the key to this chapter. 1 through 5, opposition. 24, the consequence. But then we go into verse 6 and we see all of this work of opposition that takes place. And what happens at the end of it, way down the line? Same thing. The work is stopped. And an important marker, just to fit in here, verse 23. Verse 23 is the very point you reach. And you can go straight from verse 23 into Nehemiah chapter 1. And remember the news that came to Nehemiah from his brethren that the work had stopped and there were problems in Jerusalem. That's where Nehemiah chapter 1 starts. After verse 23 of this fourth chapter of Ezra. So this writer is giving us a flash forward, taken as a way down through the years of the same kind of treatment, opposition to the work, until you get to the day of Nehemiah. And then having got to that point, at verse 23, he says, and then, back to the beginning, verse 5, then cease the work of the Lord. So you can understand now this device that these commentators have suggested, putting brackets around it. Because it shows you the line down through the years, the timeline of this chapter. What are we going to make of it if we come back now to it ourselves? One series of thoughts, one way of giving a skeleton to this. First of all, surely we have here, there is an offer that must be refused. Secondly, there are troubles that cannot be avoided. And then thirdly, there is an example that must not be followed. That's one way of understanding it. But the way I want to look at it is this. Here, in different phases and stages and light and colour, we have one theme, hostility. That's obvious when we read it. This is talking about hostility. But I want to look at this simple theme of hostility in three simple ways that possibly will help us to understand more fully this chapter. So, hostility, first of all, it's covered up. Secondly, hostility, it's open and it's obvious. Thirdly, hostility, it just runs and runs and runs. The three thoughts for this chapter tonight. First of all then, hostility, it's covered up. At the end of chapter 3, there is the initial flourish. They've laid the foundation stone. There's a time of rejoicing and joy, but there's also, because of the comparison that's made with David and Solomon's time, there is a degree of weeping and tears. So there's this initial flourish when they start the work. But it's not long past that step when the Samaritans come on the scene and they make this offer to help. It sounds sincere. The Jews returning from exile are facing a huge, enormous construction task. Surely the help of the Samaritans would certainly have been appreciated. But no. The help and the offer that the Samaritans give is dismissed curtly and almost in an abrasive way. Is there any graciousness in Zerubbabel in the way in which he speaks to these Samaritans just now? And we've got to understand the very first verse. We might read the verse and we've quickly read past it before we've understood it. Now when the adversaries, you see, Zerubbabel saw them for what they were. He knew them, what they were up to. And we've got to follow him. They were the enemy. And their hostility was covered up. There is a hidden danger in a harmless proposal. There is a hidden danger in a harmless proposal. Who were these Samaritans? They were, and it's not an offence to put it this way, they were pagan imports. They were pagan imports. We're told here in verse 2 that a king of Assyria brought us in. And that throws us back to 2 Kings chapter 17 and verse 24. Let me just go back to it briefly. 2 Kings chapter 17. And the king of Assyria brought men from Babylon, from Cuthan, and from Ava, and from Hamath, and from Seraphim, and placed them in the cities of Samaria, instead of the children of Israel. And they possessed Samaria, and dwelt in the cities thereof. And the rest of chapter 17 of 2 Kings describes. But let me come down to verse 34. And to this day, they do after their former manners. They fear not the Lord, neither do they after the statutes, nor after the ordinances, nor after the law and commandment, which the Lord commanded the children of Israel, whom he named Israel. So these nations feared the Lord and served their graven images, both their children and their children's children. As did their fathers, so they do unto this day. What were they doing? They were brought in as pagan imports. They married the residue of the Israelites that were left in the land. That produced a mixed race and a mixed religion. For these people, it was a convenient faith. Which one of the idols will we follow and back up today? If it's one of the idols of their own history, then that's convenient for this land. And if it is to follow Jehovah and to believe in the God of Israel, well, if it's convenient for us, we'll do that also. So you can see the way in which there was a mixed religion. Whatever was helpful or advanced them, they had no commitment to one or the other. And the danger was that that people would lead the nation back into idolatry. And that, after all, was the very reason behind the exile, because they had indulged in idolatry. So therefore, here we have Zerubbabel recognizing what they were up to, the danger that they presented, and he refuses them without compromise, firmly, fully, flatly. This is no concern of yours. This is our job. Hostility covered up. Application to ourselves, well, as Christians, we have to take a stance for the Lord. Sometimes, oftentimes, open confrontation with society is required. we're constantly fighting a battle to maintain a Christian stance in our nation and amongst our people. Sometimes that stance and that fight comes very personal and hurtful perhaps to ourselves, because that battle comes within our family, within our friends, within our own community, and then it gets really hard. And the temptation might come to us. Tone down. Tone down your words. Accommodate the view. Accommodate the position of other people. Don't be so harsh in what you're saying, and don't be so dogmatic in the saying of it. And the danger there is, well, if you do that, life will be a bit easier for you. It won't be so much of a struggle. And that's a danger, especially it's dangerous when it's spoken by somebody of our family, of our friends, but they're not Christians. And they say, well, just think of the doors that would open. Just think of the opportunities that you would have. But it's an offer that must be refused. We are not discourteous. We never should be. We should never be abrupt or off-putting in any way. There must always be that attractive quality about us that would attract people to the Lord. But that attractive quality must never be obtained through a slackening of our own convictions. We need, like Zerubbabel had here, we need discernment, both of characters and of dangers. We need conviction of the rightness of our own position. We need courage to hold on to it in the face of everything that is thrown at us. We need that faith and that trust to make it known with the belief and confidence that the Lord will bless His word and His work. We must be involved. We must not be isolated. We must be firm, but not offensive. And these words, they are just words, but there's a constant fight to keep them in balance in our lives. To keep that balance that makes us attractive, but not compromising what we believe in. And that's what we have there, the danger, the hostility that was presented to them here. The Lord, yes, the Lord held firmly and passionately to his understanding of man, to his understanding of society. He spoke directly, he spoke sympathetically to people. And when needed, he spoke with open confrontation. He was never, ever once compromised or compromising in what he said or what he did. Neither should we. An offer that had to be refused. It was covered up and covering up hostility. But the second thought that I have here is hostility, yes, covered up, but hostility open and obvious. Verses 4 and 5. Then the people of the land weakened the hands of the people of Judah, troubled them in building, hired counselors against them to frustrate their purpose all the days of Cyrus, king of Persia, even unto the reign of Darius, king of Persia. Year after year, this is what they did. Their initial reaction, the initial approach by the Samaritans, it was refused, it was turned down. What happened next? They didn't go away. They just tried another approach. When danger comes to threaten us and we recognize it, we resist it, that doesn't mean to say the danger goes away. just simply goes into another direction against our lives. When temptation comes to the front door of our lives and we resist it there, we've got to be very careful. Because often the devil goes and knocks on the back door then to throw in that same temptation in a different way. It was initially refused, but it didn't go away. It was then seen in its Christian colours, true Christian colours. It was against them, hostility against God's people. There was nothing subtle now. Nothing subtle at all. They broke cover. They were out after these Jews. Open and obvious. Three simple ways in which we can tease this out. Verse 4. First of all, there was a discouragement. Then the people of the land weakened the hands of the people of Judah. They weakened their resolve. They discouraged them. Oh, the work that you've got, it's too big for you little people. Oh, the work that you've got to do, it's too hard for you. It's going to take you too long. You don't have enough resources to engage in it. It's beyond your ability. If you carry on doing it like this, there's going to be so many defects in it, you're going to be dishonoring your God. Wave after wave of discouragement beating down upon their lives. Wave after wave of discouragement beating down upon us. And our heads can go down just like theirs. And that's why we were singing there in Psalm 3, which describes for us and gives us the picture of the Lord as what? The lifter up of my head. The discouragement. But not only discouragement, we also find here intimidation. They troubled them, verse 4, the latter part, they troubled them in the building. Intimidating them. This is our land. You are so few, we are so many. We've got possession, that's 9/10 of the law. You've got no protection. We can come and we can take you when we want. People that strike an intimidation stance over them. Somebody that's in control of what they need or holding ground that they want. That's ours. You're not getting it. Troubling them in the building. And the third way in which they did this open and obviously, they hired counselors against them. They wanted to discredit their name. Speaking against them. If you go to the book of Nehemiah chapter 6, 10 through 13, you'll find it's exactly what happened. Come on, Nehemiah, let's go into this wee council room and let's talk in there. Let's get away from all the crowd and get away from all the threats. And come on in. Come on. And Nehemiah saw that and recognized. He says, what? And you'll say I'm a coward? And I'll be discredited amongst all the people? No. The danger and the subtlety of discrediting the name and the reputation of these people. That's what they were up to. They hired counselors to speak against them in the court of the king. The same kind of thing happens to us. Do you know that he's one of them? Do you know he goes to that church? Do you know they actually believe in sin? They actually believe in the virgin birth. That kind of attempt to discredit the reputation of the Christian. Open and obvious. This kind of hostility was practiced. First of all, we're told they troubled them in the building, so some of it was done on site. Then in verse 5, we're told that some of it was done back in the court of the king. There are times when the hostility is face to face, Other times, it's done behind our backs. But in verses 4 and 5, the way in which it's put in the Hebrew, it's a whole series of participles. In other words, the people of the land were weakening the hands of the people. They were troubling them in the building. And they hired counselors speaking against them. It creates the impression, not only they did it once, but they kept on doing it. There was no respite. There was no rest. First this way, then another way. First of all, discouraging them, intimidating them, discrediting them. Go to the first 4 or 5 chapters of Acts and you'll find exactly the same thing there to discredit God's work that starts in the New Testament. It flips and flops. First of all, it's outside the church, then it's inside the church, then it's outside the church, then it's inside the church, then it's outside the church. 5 different examples of it in these opening verses of Acts. First one way, then another way. And when they've all gone through the list, they come back to the beginning and they start again. Open and obvious hostility. So let's go from verse 5 down to verse 24. That's the timeline. The word at the beginning, then, cease the work, reply applies to exactly what we've been talking about just a moment ago. It was effective. All of this open hostility, it worked. Because they stopped building in the year 536. And it stopped for 16 years to the year 520. The variety of opposition, it can in fact be effective for a moment. And when Haggai arrived, Haggai came in the year 520 or thereabouts to restart the work, kick-starting the work. When Haggai arrived, he did 2 things. He first of all challenged them, and then he encouraged them. And again, there's a balance between the two. This building site has been silent for 16 years. I'm not hearing any work going on. But I am hearing something going on in a private plot around your house, and around that house. And that one, but there's silence in the building of the temple. Why is that? He challenged them. But again, if you go to Haggai, and it shouts out at us, he also encourages them. He says, I'm the Lord, I'm with you. I will take pleasure in this place, in this building that you're engaged in and committed to. I am the Lord with you. Time and again, Haggai reminds them of that, to encourage them to restart this work, despite all the hostility, discouragement, and intimidation that they've experienced at the hands of these people. Their enthusiasm quickly ran out. I think we can understand that like this. When they came and the stone was laid and they started the work, and then this hostility broke out against them. There's no prayer to God. There is no petition going back to the king who sent them. They cave in too quickly. They cave in too quickly. An example we must not follow. When we're fighting on and on and on, when we're seeking to maintain a Christian stance, wherever it might be, sometimes that hostility is like a drip on a stone. It can wear us away. And all that we're wanting to do is just to give in, walk away, or to be quiet and to stop speaking and to stop fighting. What a comfortable life that would be then. But we're not allowed that option. Hostility covered up. Hostility open and obvious. Thirdly, hostility running and running. And that takes us to this section of the chapter that's in brackets. Chapters 4, verses 6 through to 23. And let's just give a summary of it to see why I've used this heading, runs and runs. Because in these verses, there are three different efforts to stop this work. We've seen in verses 1 through 5 the Samaritans. First of all, their subtlety, and then their open hostility. Is that the end of it then? Is there any more hostility, any more opposition? No, it just keeps on going on and on. And you think that's it? Just you wait till you go down through the years and the centuries. Let's see it. There's more of the same. And these verses 6 through 23, they give to us markers, time markers, very clear and plain ones, in the kings. First of all, verse 6, and in the reign of Ahasuerus. So we're beyond Cyrus, we're beyond Darius. We're way down past that in the king Ahasuerus. We're down, in fact, in the days of Esther. We're past these opening days back in Jerusalem. We're now 35, 40 years down the line. And what did they do? At the beginning of his reign, they wrote to him another accusation, trying to stop the work. It came to nothing. But let's just try to understand what they were doing. We need a little bit of secular history. It's not nothing wrong with that. We can understand it like this. When Darius died, Egypt rebelled. So Ahasuerus had to go to the west to put Egypt in its place. And can you imagine then what would have happened? There is Ahasuerus fighting the Egyptians. And they say, oh good, let's write a letter of complaint against Jerusalem. Because here is Ahasuerus and he's worried, he's apprehensive, he's in a warm frame of mind. Let's write. Let's stir the pot. Put the letter in. That's what they did. Didn't get anywhere. Didn't get very far with them. But just remember that that's the very words that were used later on in verses 12 and 13 at another time with another king. So they were always using these words of rebellion, trying to invoke and to intimidate the king to come against these exiles coming back. The first one written to Ahasuerus. But then you move on, and then we come in verse 7 to the days of Artaxerxes. They did the same again. There was no cooling of the opposition despite the passing of the years. They persisted. Perhaps even they were learning from all these different efforts they made. Didn't work with Artaxerxes, didn't work with Ahasuerus. Did they give up? No. We come to the third one in verse 8. Then Rehum, the chancellor, and Shimshai, the scribe, they wrote a letter. And they did it. We've got the text of it here. That quaint little phrase, from such and such a place and such a time. It's like Free Church Man's 16th of December. That's what they're saying. They're writing a letter. And the writing of the letter highlights three things. If you don't stop Jerusalem, you're going to lose revenue, you're going to lose respect and honour, and you're going to lose part of your country. We have maintenance from the king's palace, and it wasn't meet for us to see the king dishonour. Therefore we've written and sent and certified the king. There they are, stirring the pot. Exaggeration. Misrepresentation. It's all fair game for these people in opposition against the Jew. Israel could never do what these people were accusing them of. They could never do it. But it wasn't the point. It was used against them. So therefore the threat just runs and runs and runs. Ahasuerus, Artaxerxes, this man Rehum the Chancellor, third attempt, they don't give up. But there's one thing that we should say here, very briefly. The Jews, they gave them a stick to beat them with. The Jews gave an opportunity to be used against them. Read again verse 12. I'll read it. Be it known unto the king that the Jews which came up from us, the Jews that came up from thee to us, are come to Jerusalem, building the rebellious and the bad city, and have set up the walls thereof and joined the foundations. Did you catch it? What are they doing? They're building the walls of the city. Go back to the decree of Cyrus. The decree of Cyrus was, you're going to build the temple to restore the worship of God. End of decree. They had no permission to build the walls of Jerusalem. Now we can understand it. If they're going to live there to work, to build the temple, they need security, they need housing, they need these things of the infrastructure. But it wasn't granted them, and therefore their enemies are using it against them. Anything. And so they took it, and they ran with it. And so therefore, when we're in conflict situations, we need very, very careful attention to all the little details. Because if we overstep the mark, that will be exploited against us. It just runs and runs and runs. So now Rehum knew it, and he used it. And he used it against the Jews. He got the answer he wanted. And there in verse 23, you can almost see him running. And in haste, they came to Jerusalem. A smile on his face and the decree in his hand. And he's going to use it. And he's going to stop it this very day. To stop the work. And it did. And like we said, the stopping in verse 23 is not the same as the stopping in verse 24. Remember that verse 24. It refers back to verse 5. And the opposition that we had there through the Samaritans. But then the writer takes us down through all the history. And we come to another situation. Very similar. Where we've got the decree of the king. Stopping the work again. Down the line. But one thing before we finish. So often, we think that the evil has won the day. They've stopped the work. The devil's done it. The work's on hold. But there's a little glimmer of hope. A little shaft and ray of light. Whenever you get closer and closer to it, it becomes bigger and brighter all the time. Where is that shaft of light? Let us read again verse 21. Give ye now commandment to cause these men to cease. Stop the work. That this city be not builded. Fair game. Exactly what they were wanting. Until another commandment shall be given from me. What the king is saying is, you stop the work until you hear further. Not only you stop the work, but there is no indication whatsoever about demolishing what's been done. It's just left standing. So therefore the stage is set. Down through these years, the stage is set for further development with another person, with a new mandate to continue the work. Stop it until you hear from me. And of course we know what happened. Not only Ezra, but then Nehemiah came and was sent with a new mandate from the king to build the walls. And nobody could complain about that. Verse 24, we're closing. Then in that verse 24 only makes sense if it's linked with verse 5. Verses 6 to 23 is a digression with a purpose, to show that the opposition just runs and runs and runs. It happened then, and it's going to happen now with ourselves. The Lord was tempted, and we're told that the devil left him only for a season. Never left him permanently. But the opposition came back time and time again into the life of the Lord. And so it will be with ourselves. And we can best hold on to what we're given, and I'm closing with this, in Deuteronomy chapter 33. First of all, verse 25. Deuteronomy 33:25, thy shoes shall be iron and brass, and as thy days, so shall thy strength be. The eternal God is thy refuge, and underneath are the everlasting arms, and he shall thrust out the enemy from before thee, and shall say, destroy them. Happy art thou, O Israel. Who is like unto thee, O people, saved by the Lord, the shield of thy help, and who is the sword of thine excellency? And thine enemies shall be found liars unto thee, and thou shall tread upon their high places. Amen. Let's pray. Our Lord and our God, as we look back over these years and the experiences of thy people gone before us, we have some degree of understanding of what they're going through, because it's a reflection of what we go through from time to time ourselves. And as they were helped and encouraged, when we see the scope and the full run of their lives, so they give help to us. Because we see that thou art a God to them in all of their need, reflecting our need today. And as thou art the God who has changed not, so with confidence we look to thee to help us now, as that help was given long ago. Undertake for us, our God, and help us to walk by faith, looking to thee and leaning upon thee always. And do thou pardon us our sin, for we ask it all in Jesus' name and for his sake. Amen. We close, therefore, as I said, in Psalm 5. Psalm 5, at the beginning, give ear unto my words, O Lord, my meditation way. Hear my loud cry, my King, my God, for I to thee will pray. Lord, thou shalt early hear my voice. I early will direct my prayer to thee, and looking up an answer will expect. For thou art not a God that doth in wickedness delight, neither shall evil dwell with thee, nor fools stand in thy sight. All that ill doers are thou hates, cutst off that liars be. The bloody and deceitful man abhorred is by thee. But I into thy house will come in thine abundant grace, and I will worship in thy fear toward thy holy place. Psalm 5, we'll sing verses 1 through 5, the first three verses. Give ear unto my words, O Lord.
Give ear unto my